Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with lawyer Jim Cobb Jr., author of Flood of Lies, the St. Rita's Nursing Home Tragedy. We'll also be talking with Ramon Antonio Vargas, author of Fight, Grin, and Squarely Play the Game, the 1945 Loyola New Orleans Basketball Championship and Legacy. And I'll also have a few thoughts on the Katrina books this season. Jim Cobb Jr. is a native New Orleanian, a graduate of Tulane Law School, and a well-known trial lawyer. He's a member of the bar in Louisiana, Texas, and Florida. He's tried more than 130 cases, but he took on the case of his lifetime after Hurricane Katrina, when he agreed to defend Sal and Mabel Mangano, proprietors of the St. Rita's Nursing Home. In a new book, Flood of Lies, The St. Rita's Nursing Home Tragedy, he lets readers see what it was like to be in the eye of that legal storm. Jim Cobb, welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks very much. I love your show.
Thanks. All lawyers now think and hope that they have a book to write, and it's usually a legal thriller, like John Grisham, of course. So for you, it was just a matter of reliving your recent past, which is not as uncomplicated as that sounds. So what were the challenges in taking these 2 years of your life and putting them down on paper?
The biggest challenge was in learning how not to write like a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Because as lawyers, we write, and I teach students to, we always put our best foot forward. We put our greatest argument earliest in the game. And if you write like that in fiction or nonfiction, you give away the game. So I had to learn how to not give away everything so early.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a difficult experience to change from writing in a legal style to writing in a style, although this book is nonfiction, hopefully it reads like a novel.
Oh, it does. It's a page-turning work of nonfiction.
Thank you very much.
Now, these are horrible things to relive, and we've all been there. So,
sure.
So how was that for you?
It was extremely difficult.
I mean, had you been keeping notes the whole time?
I had not.
Did you have the thought that this would be a book?
I really didn't. And the reason it turned into a book is because every time I would tell one or two stories from it, the most important one being how I got hired in the first place,
mm-hmm.
which also answers the question of why I wrote the book. I would tell people that story and they say, you've got to write something. You got to write something.
So because tell us that story. It's a really interesting story.
It's an extraordinary story. Before the storm, I had never met Sal or Mabel Mangano. I'd never represented them. I had no idea who they were. I was in Houston. We lost our home in Lakeview with 6 feet of water. Thank you, Corps of Engineers. And we were living in a hotel room in Houston. My family didn't know where I was. In the meantime, back in Louisiana, Sal and Mabel had been evacuated to Dallas, Texas. They were sleeping on a floor of a high school gymnasium, not exactly looking at the television. The Attorney General of Louisiana was searching for them as if they were fugitives. They weren't fugitives at all. Long story short, they come back to Louisiana, they talk to their lawyer, and they're in the middle of a firestorm. And their lawyer was a young man by the name of Jeremy Goo. His dad was Ron Goo, president of the Louisiana Nursing Home Association. He called his dad and said, Dad, what do I do? And the wily Senior Goo said, you don't handle it. This is going to be a nightmare for the nursing home industry. You got to find this guy, Jim Cobb. He said, well, how do I find him? And his dad said, I don't know. You find him. Hung up on him. Long story short, he winds up in a bar room in Covington, crying in his beer, saying, I got to find this guy. I got to hire this guy, and I can't find him. I don't know if he's on a rooftop in Lakeview. In the bar room, there's a woman at the end of the bar who's listening in on their conversation who says, you talking about Jim Cobb, the lawyer from New Orleans? He said, yeah. Do you know him? And she says, no, but I have a friend who I think's mother is friends with Jim Cobb's wife.
Wow.
Do you want me to call her? She does. She'd spoken to her mother that very day for the first time since Katrina. And her mother and my wife had spoken that very day. Gave her the number. And the next morning, I got a phone call. And it was Mabel Mangano saying, Mr. Cobb, can you please help us? And that's how I got the case.
Wow.
And that's why I wrote the book.
And you took it with little hesitation. You really leapt in with your whole heart.
I did. And there are two motives for that. One, of course, is I think all lawyers have an obligation to take on the unpopular cause.
Mm-hmm.
And I was instructed unto that by David McCulloch's book about John Adams and the Boston Massacre, which I didn't know. And maybe your listeners know or don't know. But John Adams defended the folks in the Boston Massacre. And he got their acquittal. So this thing that we've come to know over the centuries as the Boston Massacre, they weren't massacres at all. So I was really inspired by that. And of course, the second reason why I took the case instantly was because I was living in a hotel room with a wife, two kids, and a dog. And I said, get me out of here. Just get me out of here.
Give me work.
Give me work. Please put this man to work.
You know, one of the things this book highlights is how tenuous our connections were after Katrina. Once again, it was just serendipitous that this guy was in this bar with this person.
Right. And Mabel doesn't believe it was serendipitous.
Well,
In fact, the title of the chapter where I explain this is called Divine Intervention. Mm-hmm. And Mabel was deeply religious, attended Catholic Mass 3 or 4 times a week for many years. And when I told her the story, I'm like, do you know how you found me? And she said, no. And I told her the story I just told you. And I said, isn't that incredible coincidence? She said, no, he sent you to me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, Mabel, I got enough pressure on me right now as it is without being God's selection to be your defense counsel, but I appreciate the thought.
So it's very hard for readers to go back to those Katrina events. You know, do you do that yourself? Do you read the other books?
The only other book I read was Jed Horn's Breach of Faith, which you don't want to read if you're a writer because he writes so well. It's intimidating. It's intimidatingly good.
And he encouraged you a lot.
He encouraged me a lot. He was a real inspiration. But no, I didn't read the other Katrina books because it was too hard. And this will open some older wounds. But given the range and the breadth of what we talk about, it also will provide some closure for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it will also explain to a lot of people who had preconceived notions of presumed guilt. It'll explain that maybe we shouldn't do that as a society. Maybe we should not jump to the first conclusion that we see in the first news story. And that the impact of that on picking a jury, when we ultimately got to pick a jury, was very difficult.
Well, you describe your whole conduct of this case, well, any trial at all, as a war, and that you were fighting not only the Attorney General of Louisiana, the media at large, it
Correct.
Seems.
Correct.
So I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about that.
Well, the media, usually it's a politician who jumps on a case, and then the media follows, and they decide whether or not to support the position of the politician, attorney general, district attorney, whatever. This case was a little different. In this case, the media jumped on the bandwagon first and had reported that these folks had abandoned their residence, that they had tied them to their wheelchairs, they tied them to their beds, they were seen shopping in Mississippi or even at a casino. It was all false. But the attorney general watches that kind of news, and then he jumped on their bandwagon so that what you then had was an unholy alliance between media, national media, and a prosecutor in Louisiana to go after these two small fish, little folks, grandma and grandpa from St. Bernard Parish. And how often does the little guy win against the media and a politician seeking re-election? Not very often.
Mm-hmm. What kind of feedback have you gotten from early readers of this book?
Early readers of this book have told me almost every single one of them says, I couldn't put it down. Mm-hmm. That they read the first chapter, and that's the most often heard thing that I hear. I couldn't put it down. Gambit Magazine, Clancy Dubose, he read it, and I got an email from him about 3 o'clock in the morning one day that said, shame on you. I couldn't go to sleep. I'm reading your book. You owe me lunch.
And then if he goes to sleep, you could give him nightmares. I speak from personal experience.
Well, I hope I don't give anybody any nightmares, but that chapter, The Wall of Water, what describes what happens on the inside of the nursing home is graphic. But it had to be graphic in order to describe what the Manganos went through as a family.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine, all of us that went through Katrina, we lost everything at my house. We lost our home. I lost my business. I couldn't work anymore. My kids went to 3 different schools. We lived in 4 different places. Imagine if in the middle of all that, somebody was trying to put you in jail, you and your wife, for the rest of your life. It's unimaginable to me. And I lived through it. So it has a bit of that to it. But we hope that the ending ties up some loose ends.
Well, you have that great common thread with New Orleanians. I mean, there's that incredible picture of your son, Chris, in front of your house with all his possessions on
the
street.
He's got a mask on. I thought it was important. My wife and I actually talked about that. Should the kids see what our house looks like? And I thought he was old enough that he should, because his imagination for what it might be was probably worse than the reality of it. So we went to our house and put on a mask and gloves and pulled out all our possessions and threw them in the street in front of our house. That's probably something 13-year-olds should avoid.
Right. Well, what do you want readers to take away from this, really?
I want readers to take away from this the journey of two different families who didn't know each other before this storm and through an incredible set of circumstances wind up together in the biggest criminal case in America. At the time the case was tried, it was the biggest criminal case in America. So the inside story of that, to anybody who likes legal thrillers, murder mysteries, etc., it's a tremendous inside look at that. The other thing I want folks to take away is that the little guy can put up a fight against the big guy. And in this case, if Sal and Mabel, as they were charged with 118 counts of homicide and cruelty to the elderly and infirm, the question that rings out is, if they didn't kill the folks at St. Rita's, who did? And the book answers that question.
Oh, yeah. And you found that people have a terrific short-term memory about this case, even.
It's amazing. Over the last 6 or 7 years, I'll talk to people in Louisiana, outside Louisiana, those folks in other states. I'll say, do you remember that, the 35 folks that died in nursing home? Oh, yeah, that was terrible. That was horrible. And I'll ask, do you remember how it turned out? 90% of the folks outside of Louisiana don't remember. 50 or 60% of the folks inside Louisiana don't remember how it turned out. You can find out how it turned out in this book.
Well, I know. Thankfully, I remembered. I feel very good about that. Oh, what did writing this book do for you personally? Did it give you a sense of closure? Did you feel that you were moving on?
I think it was helpful in that. I think I had already closed the book on all the stuff that we went through once the trial was over. I'd also changed my job. I couldn't basically quit my law firm.
Yeah.
Which was a career-changing event. Whenever you get in this kind of a case, the sacrifice you make is you cut yourself off from your clients, you cut yourself off from your partners. Everybody knows you're carrying two people on your shoulders, that if you're not successful, they go to jail for the rest of their lives. And that's different than just a money case. That's different than just a little money here and a little money there. So it's a kind of representation that really takes it out of you. And when you've been doing it for 32 or 33 years, I'm not sure how many more of these I had in me. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like sharing this story, this journey, not the destination, but the journey, was the right way to go.
Wow.
And in writing it, might have been as hard as trying the case. It certainly lasted longer.
I can imagine.
It takes a long time.
Yes, it did.
It takes a long time.
We've been talking with Jim Cobb, author of Flood of Lies, The St. Rita's Nursing Home Tragedy. You can meet him Tuesday, September 3rd at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie, and Thursday, September 5th at 6 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. Thank you so much, Jim.
It was a pleasure being here. Thank you.
Ramon Antonio Vargas is a reporter for NOLA.com, as well as a graduate of Loyola University here in New Orleans. He combines his passion for sports with his love of his alma mater in his first book, Fight, Grin, and Squarely Play the Game, the 1945 Loyola New Orleans Basketball Championship and Legacy, from History Press. It has a lovely foreword from veteran sports writer Pete Finney as well. Welcome to The Reading Life, Ramon.
Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
There's something so romantic about sports reporting. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. I think it.
And there's such a combination of stories of heroism with facts and figures. And this book seems to have all of that.
It was a lot of fun to kind of flesh out. I think early in the reporting of it, I was reviewing a lot of box scores and just a lot of stats, and they were just names on a line. And then I guess fleshing it out and talking to either the players themselves or their surviving relatives to kind of bring those numbers and those achievements that were just on paper at one point to life was one of the most gratifying experiences of my career.
So this book had its roots in your student experiences at Loyola working for the Maroon, right?
Yes. Early in my career at the Maroon, which I was fortunate enough to be editor of at one point, I was covering the men's basketball team, and it was toward the end of the season, and I had some free time. I was just hanging out in the office. The issues are archived in these bound volumes, and I pulled one of those volumes out. It really the question was, I wonder what it was like to go to Loyola during World War II. And I knew the war was ending in 1945, so I chose a 1944-45 school year, stumble across the headline informing readers that Loyola won a national basketball championship. Considering that I was the men's basketball writer and was not aware that my own school had won a national championship, A, I was pretty embarrassed, but B, I was stunned and excited to learn that. I follow sports in New Orleans closely, and I wasn't aware of it. So does my father. When I asked him, did you know that Loyola won a basketball championship? And he was like, no, not at all. And I was floored. And so I started reading everything I could on the team, starting from the championship to the beginning of the season, which was kind of a strange approach, but familiarized myself with all the characters on that team and went from there.
Well, some time had passed. I think you could be forgiven for not knowing, really. But there's nothing more fun than to find this undiscovered or forgotten story and bring it back to life. So tell me about the title, which I love so much. It's so inspirational.
I grew to love the title. It's a line from the fight song, the first version of the fight song, which has been updated to be more gender neutral. But early, that's a line in there. And I was reluctant at first. I knew the fight song, but when it was proposed to me by the publisher, I was reluctant because I'm like, I mean, it took me a minute to realize what you were talking about, and I can't imagine that anyone's going to look at it and know exactly what we're referring to. However, I grew to love it when I saw how big of a character almost World War II was in the story. You've got fight, and then just the duty that a lot of the students and the players had, which was to either interrupt their athletic or academic careers and go fight in the war. And the whole idea of just grin and bear it, right? It's your duty. Do it. And so many of these players did and squarely play the game of, you know, Loyola and Jesuit ideals. You taught whatever your job. You know, I mean, when I was studying to be a journalist, I had to take two ethics courses. And it was a journalism ethics and then just in a regular ethics class. So it just embodied, I think, the team and, to me, what's one of the highest achievements the university has ever had, perfectly in one phrase. So I grew to love it, and I'm
glad
they
did. Great spirit. You know, yeah. It's a rousing title, sure. Which I like a lot.
Thank you.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me about this book is the way, you know, it's one of those stories where you take this group of people and you see so much of not just their era, but the history of our city in their lives. So tell us about some of the individuals and how they captured your attention.
Sure. I mean,
and let me say now, you've met a lot of these guys.
I did. I got to meet a lot of them, and their memories are, they recall some very big moments of the season, but it's just been so far removed that they just kind of have a general idea of that it was a very pleasant time in it. I mean, they range from, there was one gentleman by the name of Sam Foreman, who is a dentist now and lives in Lafayette. He was 24. He was studying dentistry through the V-12 program. It was a naval program that Loyola had offered on its campus. So he was a graduate student actually playing, and he was 24. His youngest teammate was 17. For example, I think he embodies it. He was such an important part to get them to the national championship, yet he couldn't leave because of the restrictions of the program in which he couldn't leave the city for an extended amount of time. And the war gave Loyola the opportunity to offer it, and then his commitment to the program prevented him from going, you know, traveling to Kansas City and helping Loyola kind of chase that. I think he very closely embodies it. And then, of course, the star player, Leroy Chalet, who kind of shows the sadder aspects of, I guess, the era, which was he had a black ancestor. And at the end of the season, though he was the best player, it surfaced that he was mixed. And the book gives a pretty detailed account of how it happens, but in the end, he and his family had to leave because it surfaced that he had a black ancestor in New Orleans, which was segregated back then. That was an issue that was something that was insurmountable for his family, and they had to relocate. So I think those are just two examples of players, but all of them became very prominent members of the community. Yeah.
One of them was the founder of Kehoe France. Another was a good friend of Edwin Edwards.
And the founder of Lake Castle, which mm-hmm. a lot of my friends attended growing up. So to me, one of the things that kind of motivated me to get through it is that reminders of them and their lives are all around us.
Right.
And I think some people, like, you just mention them and then it all clicks. You just mentioned, like, oh, like this player, well, he founded Lake Castle. Oh, like I went there. My friends went there. My siblings went there. And same thing with Kehoe France. And
And so many dentists. I love the picture of the dental school.
Yeah.
It's just
the picture of, I think he's just kind of standing in front of a dental chair with a student and they're examining mm-hmm. each other's teeth. It just seemed, and it's crazy because the shell of the buildings are still there, but obviously the classrooms have been changed so much. But I worked on the project as a student a little bit. And in my, you know, once I graduated, obviously, but when I was aware of the story and just walking through the buildings, I just wondered, like, all these men that went before me that accomplished this great thing. And, you know, inside the very structure that I was in, it was a really unique feeling. That,
well, they really come alive for the reader. They do. It's such a wonderful combination of stories, and these photographs are, they're just unforgettable. You must have had a lot of fun with that.
I did. The university opened its trove of photographs to me, and it really brought in a way that no matter how carefully crafted a sentence is, I mean, some of those photographs are really amazing, and I owe everything to the university because they really were like, anything that's helpful to you, please. You have our permission to use. So.
Well, it's a great New Orleans story. We've been talking with Ramon Antonio Vargas, the author of Fight, Grin, and Squarely Play the Game, the 1945 Loyola New Orleans Basketball Championship and Legacy. Thanks, Ramon.
Thank you.
It's that time of year again. Time for remembering and looking forward, measuring how far we've come and how far we have yet to go. Hurricane season always brings its memories of Katrina, and books come along with those memories. This year, the books are rich and varied. Two will strike raw nerves and are sure to be talked about. If reading can be a harrowing experience, and I think it can, prepare to be horrified. Today's guest, Jim Cobb Jr., recounts one of the big stories of 8 years ago in Flood of Lies, the St. Rita's nursing home tragedy, in which 35 elderly residents died in a St. Bernard nursing home in the flood. Owners Sal and Rita Mangano were eventually acquitted after charges were brought against them, and Cobb tells his version of those events, along with his own story of evacuation, loss, and return. No matter how you feel about the outcome of that case, Cobb's book deftly illuminates the way the legal system was shattered and the way the media machine rolled on like a juggernaut in those days. Sherry Fink won a Pulitzer Prize for her reporting on the crisis at Memorial Medical Center after Katrina, and now she's written a full-length, moment-by-moment account of those times in 5 days at Memorial, Life and Death in a Storm-Ravaged Hospital, due out in September. In painstaking detail, she shows us how one of our large medical institutions struggled to maintain order and provide care after the storm, and how rescue efforts failed again and again. Along the way, she also gives us a guided tour of medical bureaucracy, the brutal realities of a hospital without power, surrounded by water, as well as the harsh truths of triage. It is a commonplace to praise fiction for reading like a novel, but the horrors of Fink's book will ring all too true for those of us who know the chaos that ensues when basic services are stripped away. One book does have a truly joyful and uplifting side. You can tell by the title. That's Second Line Rescue, Improvised Responses to Katrina and Rita, edited by Barry-Jean Ancelet, Marcia Godet, and Carl Lindahl. I love this book. I was moved and shaken by it, as readers are by all the best stories. As folklorist, Ancelet, Godet, and Lindahl knew that what would remain long after Katrina and Rita were stories. They set about collecting them with all their skill as folklorist. Lindahl focusing on New Orleans West, and that's Houston, of course. The writers share not only improvised responses like that of the Cajun Navy, and the photos of all those boats heading toward New Orleans is enough to lift the heart of anyone. They concentrate as well on individuals. In an interview with Glenn Magez, who rescued stranded residents in Del Cambre after Hurricane Rita, Barry Ancelet asked him, "Did anybody you had picked up contact you?" And Magez replies, "Yeah, everybody. They were saying you're a hero. I'm not a hero. I was just doing what I had to do. You know what I mean, not a hero. They said you didn't have to do that. I know I didn't have to, but somebody had to do it. It was there to do. And I'd do it again. I hope I don't have to, but I'd do it again." One of the fascinating stories is the way the Atchafalaya Welcome Center was devoted to relief efforts, providing food and shelter and rudimentary medical care. Perhaps no one describes the emotional complexities of that time better than Lieutenant Nick Brough of the Sheriff's Department of St. Martin Parish. He said, "I've never cried so many type tears in my life." Folklore serves to remind us of our common humanity, and several themes emerge in the stories collected in Second Line Rescue. The power of individual action to make a difference, the courage of folks under incredible stress, the generosity of individuals, the shared power of food and faith, the need to give to others, and the way the expression of gratitude lingers long after the fact. This book is a real testament to the power of our stories to move us beyond ourselves into the future. The authors tell us, "But those who think they know Katrina and Rita are sadly mistaken. We've only just met." That's what they write, to remind us of the lingering problems and all that is left to learn. The words of community activist Glenda Jones Stevenson Harris, who died in 2010, may say it best. "I know that my responsibility is to go back and build New Orleans back again, because for all its problems of high crime, for all its problems of poverty, for all its problems of political corruption, for all its problems of a failing school system, it was still the city that people cared about. It was still a city that people who loved, loved hard. And we still do, Miss Harris. We still do." Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. The West Bank Writers Group meets every Tuesday at 6 at Barnes & Noble West Bank. Doreen Cronin and illustrator Betsy Lewin read from and sign their new children's book, Click Clack Boo, A Tricky Treat, Wednesday, August 28th at 4 at Octavia Books. The one-time, one-book pop-up book club for all of you who've been reading Cervantes' Don Quixote, that time is here. Come to the one and only meeting Thursday, August 29th at Belloc on Lee Circle at 7 p.m. Margaret Haddix Peterson signs Wrist and Lisa McCann signs Island of Fire, two new books for young adults, Tuesday, September 3rd at 4 at Octavia Books. The First Tuesday Book Club discusses the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel The Orphan Master's Son by Adam Johnson, Tuesday, September 3rd at 5:30 at Maple Street Bookshop on Maple Street. And Rebecca Morgan Frank, author of Little Murders Everywhere, is the first featured reader in the 1718 reading series, the student-run literary group, Tuesday, September 3rd at 7 at the Collins Hotel. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.